Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Carrie Adloyd. How do we grieve for someone? How does it change and evolve as we get older? My dad died when I was 15, and it took me many, many years to be able to express what I had gone through. So I decided to create Griefcast, a chance to talk, share, and laugh about the weirdness of grief and death. But with comedians, so it's not that depressing, I promise. Each time I talk to a different comedian about their own personal experience of grief as we remember someone that they have lost along the way. Whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club, this is a chance to talk about the peculiar human process of death. Welcome to Griefcast.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Thank you for listening. We had some more nice news this week, which is really appreciated when you do a weekly show about death. We have been nominated for 2 Mixcloud Awards in Rising Star and Best Comedy. Very exciting. Also to be nominated for Best Comedy. Very exciting. And because we've been nominated, you can also vote for us on the Listener's Choice Award. If you head to Mora, MORA.FM, and click on the Best Online Talk Show category, Griefcast should come up. And it's also the last week you can vote for us in the British Podcast Awards for Listener's Choice. If you head to britishpodcastawards.com/nominations2018, you can vote for us there. Sorry for all the admin. And thank you so much for listening to these conversations. We wouldn't be nominated for so many Listener's Choices if you weren't. So thank you. This week's guest is journalist and author Clover Stroud. Clover has written for The Times, The Telegraph, The Spectator, Elle magazine, as well as writing several books. Her latest one is called The Wild Other and has just come out in paperback. It's a memoir of her life and her experience living with grief and trauma. Clover came in to talk to me about her mother, who suffered horrific brain damage from a riding accident when Clover was a teenager, and her mother's eventual death in 2013. Welcome to Griefcast. I'm here today with journalist and writer Clover Stroud. Hello.
Hi. We're
there. Moaning about the weather. That's all we've done mainly so far.
Well, we've got something to moan about with the weather today.
I felt that today. I was upset it was so cold, but also I was like, oh, I'm going to get some good weather chat today. I'm going to have with everybody, bus drivers, people on the tube, going to get a lot.
No, I think we're more obsessed. This winter, the end of this winter has made us, as a nation, way more obsessed by the weather than ever before.
We had snow in March and a heat wave.
I know.
Now this, it's like everything rolled into one. You must have had a busy morning because, Clover, you have 5 children.
I've got 5 kids, yeah. So before coming up here, and I live in Oxfordshire, they all had to be... got off to their various schools. They're ranging from 17. My eldest is 17 and my youngest is just over 1. So there's quite a kind of range of needs that have to be dealt with.
It makes me feel sick. Like, because I have 1, and as we said, she's just over 1, the idea of having to get one of them to school and then nurse, like, what for you? You're doing school?
So the old Jimmy gets on I have to drive him to go and get on his bus to go to his sixth form college. And then my daughter Dolly, she gets on the bus literally just outside the house, which is great.
That's great.
And then the 3 little ones are at, one's at, you know, a primary school in a village, and another one's at preschool, and then the last one is actually still at home.
So
it's lots of different, you know, a kind of tsunami of different amounts of shoes, school bags, packed lunches. It's really chaotic. It's really hectic, the morning. But I do quite like it as well. I quite like the intensity of, I have to get up and then I have to, like, if anybody else is doing it, like if my husband is trying to, so you have to, once you get up, you just have to go and you have to keep going. You can't stop. You can't pause in order to get them all to, you know,
but
to
you
the right
must
places.
There must be a bit of you that does like it, because I think
definitely
it's too mad a life to choose by, like, being like, oh, I don't really like chaos or children, but
no, I do. I think that I like the idea of order and that I want everything to be in a certain way, but I don't actually. I really like chaos. And when I had 2 kids in my 20s, and then I got divorced, and then I met my husband now, and we started having more children. And somebody said, well, you could just have, like, had 1 child.
You
didn't have to have, like, another
3.
And I had, and after I had the 4th, we had 2 boys and 2 girls. And lots of people said at that point, oh, it's so, you know, symmetrical. It's really neat. But in a way, I kind of wanted to mess it up,
I suppose. Yeah.
And I like that feeling that it's all coming at you in a big way. And I think that's partly, I'm the youngest of 5. So you are kind of.
Did you feel then, was a bit of you that, like, oh, there's not me yet? Like, I've got 4, I'm the youngest of 5. Like, where's the Clover in this situation?
No, I don't. I haven't actually ever thought of that. I just had, once I had the 4th, even though I was really, really tired, and I, you know, I had had some postnatal depression as well. So I kind of, it hasn't all been straightforward. I'm lucky I had, I've had 5 really good births, but I have had difficulties with the whole kind of maternal role. But after the 4th, I just thought, oh, there's like room for another one, definitely. And actually, I was at a party on, it was my dad's 70th on, Saturday, and somebody had a newborn baby, and I held it, and that smell of baby's head is so dangerous.
See, I know mums have said that to me before, but I don't have that yet. Like, if I see a newborn, I'm like, like, imagine the screaming. Like, I'm still too, like, what's the word? Like, still shell shocked from the war. Like, I'm not past it yet. Yeah, it's still very close. It's still a bit too near. So your life is pretty chaotic anyway. But who are we remembering today specifically?
Well, specifically, it's my mum.
Right.
And her kind of story is a very, very strange one. And my relationship with grieving and grief is a very strange one as well, because mum died in 2013. And so that was relatively recently. But when I was 16, and I'm 43 now, I grew up in the countryside and had this really wonderful kind of, you know, pretty idyllic childhood with ponies and a very loving, warm mother, big chaotic family life. And then, but we grew up with ponies. And then mum was riding when I was 16. I'd gone off to school. I was in the first term of my A-levels. And she fell off her horse on some concrete on an old airfield. And she was then in a coma for sort of 3-4 months. When she woke up, it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't as you see. Somebody waking up from a coma in real life is not the way it's presented in movies at all. Yeah. It's a very slow process. But when she woke up, it became slowly clear, because to start with, you know, the fact that she had she had sort of come back to life, as it were. Mm. We felt we can look after her, and we were told that she had very profound brain damage. But we thought with the right amount of love and rehabilitation and care from us, she would be able to live with us, and we would be able to, you know, some version of her would come back. But she, it became clear. I mean, she came to live with us for the initially, and I was.
So you were 16.
I was 16, and my sister Nell was like 18 at the time. So, and my eldest brothers and sisters had left home at that point. And my dad actually always worked in London, and we were at home in the country. So basically Nell and myself were at home with Mum on our own with kind of nurses and carers, because she needed full-time nursing care. And she had... although, I mean, she was very strange because she could stand up and she could walk around and she could, like, lift up a cup of tea and drink a cup of tea, but she didn't... She did these are sort of automatic impulses. Yeah. Like she could get into a car and put a seatbelt on. So the first time she got into a car, we thought, oh, this is extraordinary.
She's okay.
She's going to get better. Yeah. You know, it's going to be a long, slow process, but she's going to get better. And she lived at home for 2 years, and I was doing my A-levels, and it was pretty... crazy time. We had like different people would come and help look after her because she was kind of like doubly incontinent. She was epileptic.
Oh,
she couldn't talk or communicate in any way at all. So she couldn't write. She couldn't point to anything. She couldn't, you know, she couldn't do like the most basic sign language to say, I'm cold. You know, she couldn't point to a heater or a drink saying she was thirsty or whatever. But we kind of battled on, and then it became clear after about 2 years, and we were all really, really falling apart at the seams, as you can probably imagine, that she needed really specialist help. So then she went into a rehabilitation centre, full-time rehabilitation centre, and then she lived in institutions for the next 22 years until she died in 2013. And she, I mean, part of Mum's kind of tragedy, really, a big part of her tragedy, was that she did have some kind of awareness. It's very difficult to know what she really understood or what she didn't understand, because she couldn't communicate. I mean, she couldn't communicate at all.
And that never came back. There never any never, sort of ever, system developed or...
No, I mean... The nurses that knew her very, very, very well, who lived, you know, who looked after her, and she was really, really beautifully looked after in incredible Sue Ryder nursing home for a while. There was a nursing home in Wiltshire near where we lived, and she, the predominantly female nurses who looked after her were just so wonderful. And they said they could kind of understand if she was uncomfortable.
Yeah.
They could kind of see from her, you know, her gestures that she might be uncomfortable. But she basically couldn't communicate anything at all. And also when I was at university, about 4 years after she had the accident, she was in a rehab centre in Kent, and she did have some kind of awareness. Like the only thing that she ever communicated, about a couple of years after the accident, she drew a picture of a horse's head, and she'd, you know, she was riding when the accident happened, and she wrote underneath it, "I wrecked myself." So she did. She knew that something had happened.
Yeah.
But it was like you'd walk into the room to see her, and she would sort of look at you, and sometimes a look of some kind of recognition would pass her face, but then she would just look away. And but when she was a few years after the accident, she was in this rehabilitation centre, and she got her hands on some drugs because she was on a lot of anticonvulsants and lots of different medication. She took a big overdose, and she was then in a coma again, and she then was even more disabled. Then she was like couldn't really walk after that. That was in when I was about 20. So, you know, Mum was in this. She had been a very charismatic, very amazing, loving woman, and then really, you know, pretty much overnight she was kind of reduced to this real shell of the person that she had been. And so that was, you know, that's the grief that I suppose that I've lived with.
So for 22 years.
Yeah.
That is a huge amount of time.
Yes, that was, I mean...
Like, how
was...
did you... I mean, there's so much to unpack. Like, so when you were 16 and it happened, and so my dad died when I was 15, so, like, I know that sort of teenage, not quite what I had, not quite understanding. Like, how were you... At school, do you remember being like, oh, this is just how, or were you, do you think you were just in sort of in shock? Because
when I look back on it, I find it, and I've, you know, I've written about this in depth.
Yeah.
And I found it interesting how much I could remember when I really sat kind of quietly writing. I could remember stuff. But when I actually think very, very deeply about the first few years, it's kind of like a, you know, quite big blur, really. Because I think that when you've been through something very, very traumatic, I do think your brain sort of stops you remembering. It doesn't want to go back to that place. And I know that, you know, even talking about it now, I can feel kind of the impulse of tears, you know, that feeling of tears.
Oh my
there.
God,
it's all the pain of it and what happened in those first few years is absolutely with me and part of me. And so, but at 16, I mean, I was in the first term of my A-levels. Mm. It was in November that it happened. And so I just started at this sixth form college. And
were you at school when you found out?
Yeah, I was in school. I mean, I remember it really clearly.
Yeah.
I was in a lesson and my sister arrived, turned up and said, oh, Mum's had this accident. And when you're around horses a lot, you know, lots of people have accidents, break legs, break arms. It's not unusual. And so I remember thinking, well, you know, I said to Nell, my sister, oh, is it a bad accident? Does she, how is, do you think she'll, will she be sitting up when we get there? You know, what? And Nell had already seen her actually that morning, and she was totally unconscious and covered in blood. She was out of this cottage hospital where she'd been taken to initially before she went to the hospital in Bristol. And she was unconscious from the moment of the accident. And so Nell kind of had a, you know, an understanding of, I mean, none of us knew what we were facing at that point, but she knew that it was a pretty appalling accident. And I remember that day really very, very clearly of being with my family and driving to Bristol, to the hospital, being driven to Bristol and kind of, you know, going into intensive care and suddenly seeing Mum, who was, it was the sort of thing, you know, I don't know if you had this when you were younger, but I really remember as a child thinking, oh, I wonder what it's like being called out of lessons to be told your parents been killed. It's almost like a sort of like weird kind of fantasy of horror that you have. And then it actually happens to you. And it's funny, actually, because my son, who's 17, is now at the same sixth form college where was. And at his parents' evening the other day, I went up to the very classroom where I had been.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, it's almost like you're immediately transported back into the moment. And it was very strange being there with Jimmy, who's like, you know, my big, lovely, tall 17-year-old son, and we were sort of having quite a laugh together. And then suddenly I was back as the 16-year-old in the room.
Did you tell him? Did you
say? No, we talked about it a lot because also he's grown up with me. You know, I've carried this.
Yeah, of course.
And he knew Mum as well. Obviously, he was born in 2000, so he was 13 when she died. So he, as a child, would come and visit her and come and see her a lot. So he obviously knew that I had this you know very loving relationship. But then the strange thing was his grandmother was always this very 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 brain damaged lady in a nursing home. So it was quite a big moment in a way, that going back.
Yeah,
it's almost like going back to the scene of the crime where I was when it happened. I think when something big and traumatic has happened to you, you do remember, you know, you remember exactly what you were doing at that moment. You probably remember exactly where you were when your dad died, where you hurt.
No, absolutely. And I was, again, writing about it the other day, and I had to remember when they sort of told me. And in my head, I was like, oh, I can't remember. And then immediately I was, like, on the sofa in the living room, and I could see where he was sitting.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I can remember, but I don't want to remember.
Yeah.
Because I remember it, like you said, the similar situation. Like, I had a very idyllic childhood and, you know, it was suburbs, but it was very lovely.
Yes.
And everything was basically fine.
Yeah.
And I remember that feeling of, like, your world sort of going, like... just not upside down, but it was like 45 degrees.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, everything's not where it should be. And that makes me feel very like, and I was describing this today, like being in the deep end, like you go to put your foot down, you're like, oh, the floor isn't there, is it?
Yeah.
I thought the floor was there.
Yeah.
So then you feel a bit like, oh shit, where's the, I'm in too deep. Like, well, I thought I was in the shallow end. Like, suddenly
no,
not.
And it's exactly in that moment that life profoundly changes.
Oh God, yeah.
And I think that it does for, I think that moment basically comes to everybody at some point. You're very lucky,
I think so,
if you get to be, you know, a grown-up adult and it hasn't happened. Although I think, you know, there's something almost a bit weird about sometimes when you meet people who everything has been relatively straightforward. Oh God, you know, there might have been a divorce.
I
there might
find
have been
those
something,
people so strange.
But there
yeah.
hasn't been the big thing. And, yeah. and a good friend of mine has had something very, very bad happen to her recently. And we were talking about it and we were saying her life has changed profoundly, but it's like being given the kind of, how do we describe it, the truth or something. It's
yeah.
like there is something which is, I mean, it's horrific, it's terrifying, but there is almost like a gift or something in it. Sometimes I wonder whether that's me telling myself that to, in order to kind of yeah. make it less painful.
I have that because I'm very, I try and be very positive about it. And I'm like, you know, I learned at 15 what some people learn at 40, that death comes to us all and we're all going to get there. And then I'm like, are you just spinning it? Because otherwise it's so shit like that happened to you. Like, I think it's both true. Like,
yeah,
there is a spin to it because otherwise, well, you just be, this is awful.
It's the human desire to want to, because we have to keep going.
Yeah,
we have to keep going.
But also there is a truth to it. Of like, people, I know what you mean. I met someone once. I met someone recently and they said, oh, I've never lost anyone. And I thought, and they were older than me. And I was like, what the fuck? Like, what do you mean? Like, literally, what are you telling me? Like, a family pet is the most you've done? And I just couldn't get my, and then actually, I think for most people, I think if they say that, it's not true. I think there is, they often, their friend's mum or their friend's dad, like, but they protect themselves. They their spin is, I'm safe, I didn't get touched by it. And you're like, we all do. We all know, you know, like somebody who's something, like that's,
no,
we're all in the same village,
definitely.
Basically.
And I think being able to talk about it and share it and is really, really important. And basically it's been my way of kind of surviving it, actually.
God,
and throughout my teenage and 20s and 30s, and now, is often trying to seek out the people who you can have the conversation with and the dialogue about what has happened what has kind of gone before, and how, because also once it's happened, and if you've got, you know, as most of us have got people in our lives, friends, relatives, partners, children, whatever, who we love, you know, you don't have to be related to them by blood, but the people that we love, we're going to lose, you know, we're all going to go through it. We're all going to lose people. We're all going to be bereaved. We're all going to face difficult stuff. And, you know, sometimes I look at the future and I think, shit, you know, what is coming? And there's in the last year in my own life personally, there's been some quite major, major, more big traumas and tragedies. And that was a kind of real stumbling block for me, actually, because I didn't expect these big things to be happening right now as well. And knowing that, it's life, you know, it is life, it is part of being human as well.
I think it's so important to acknowledge that it's like, it's just the job, that is it.
Yeah.
But Julia Samuels, who I talk about a lot, the grief psychotherapist, and she said something to me where she was like, why do you think you don't get pain? She was like, what made, you know, everybody gets pain.
Yeah.
What made you think you wouldn't? And I was like, oh, yeah, I just don't like it. It's like, yeah, you don't like, sure, you don't like it, but that is the job of being human.
That's,
it's 50% awful, 50% brilliant.
Yeah,
and you just try and make the brilliant percentage over as much as possible. Mm. But so to go back a bit, so she was, so, you know, you had your kids while she was in institutions.
Yeah.
How was that, becoming a mother without her?
Without her being
there,
around.
But also she, I mean, that's a really difficult situation.
Yeah, it was. So mum, the grief for mum was like carrying this, this long-term trauma and grief. It was like frozen grief. But with the kids, I found being pregnant and having children without her there was like one of the hardest things I have ever done. And I found it increasingly difficult with each child as well. And also because she was a really, she loved babies, she loved childbirth, she loved the whole stuff of you know, small, especially babies. And she used to say when I was growing up, oh, you know, I can't wait for you to have children and we'll be, there'll be so many wonderful things that we can share together.
Yeah.
And going through that process without her has been really difficult. And I feel really lucky because because she gave me a kind of... she put into my head the idea that childbirth and pregnancy could be a really, really wonderful thing.
Yeah.
And I think that because I was so wanting to carry something of her forward, that I really have held on to that. And I was really, I've been really lucky to have had, I had five really good births, which I'm really grateful for. I mean, I have had problems as well. I've had miscarriages and things. It hasn't all been straightforward. And then with my third and fourth, I had postnatal depression as well, where I felt really, really bleak for quite a long time. And I think that that was, I mean, my two eldest kids I had in my 20s, and my life at that point was really quite chaotic. By the age of 27, 28, I was like, I had a toddler and a newborn baby, and I was a single mother, basically. So I had to just kind of keep motoring onwards. I couldn't, like, look around me. And I think, yeah. I don't think I had postnatal depression in my 20s. I might have done, but I was so...
Well, yeah, we were saying earlier before we started recording that sometimes if other stuff's going on, it's hard to know.
Yeah.
Because I definitely think I did have something, but when there's other stuff happening at the same time, it's really hard to separate. And I can imagine... Especially if you'd already dealt, well, you were dealing with the trauma of your mother.
The trauma of, yeah. I mean, she was still alive.
Yeah,
at that
that's
point.
What I mean. So she's still alive.
Yeah.
You're now a single mother. You've got, I guess maybe you just went, I'm just not going to think about this. I'm just going to get up and get dressed. Like
I was just starting out as a freelance journalist then, and I had to kind of like, I just had to keep going. And then when I had my daughter, who's now five, Evangeline, in my 30s, after I'd met my second husband, and I was really, you know, life was ostensibly, everything was really good. I met a really nice guy.
Did that scare you?
Well, definitely. I had this beautiful little baby girl, and then I had this really, really, like, real deep melancholy and deep grief, I suppose, come over me. In the form of postnatal depression. And I think I did feel like everyone kept saying to me, oh, you know, I'm so happy for you. Everything's finally worked out. It's almost like saying, your life was such a mess before. But now, look, it's all good and it's all great. And so you feel this like real sense of, pressure, I think, to kind of really enjoy it and really be happy. And everything is so, so wonderful now.
And also, have you been carrying... that's such a lot to carry around with you. And I think also when you have a baby, the other thing that happens is if you have a bit more time.
Yeah.
Like suddenly, you know, you're a bit, oh, I don't have to do that thing today. So all those thoughts that you're like, don't deal with that, bubble up a bit.
Well, you also have all that time of being on your own with the baby. You spend a hell of a lot of time on your own, don't you? Whatever way you're feeding, you're still going to be sitting there on a sofa or in bed or whatever on your own with this little child. And that kind of... I got really hit really hard by this feeling of their happiness, these children's happiness is in my hands. I didn't worry about whether I could, you know, I didn't worry about them, you know, their sort of health and stuff like that, but it was like their mental health I kept thinking about. And also I've got to make the kind of texture of their childhood and the memory of their earliest memories.
So much pressure. I can't imagine with five. Like, spend off with one thinking, because you remember things as a child and you start realising... You know, those things that you were like, oh, that's weird. Why are my parents doing that? Like, that's now you.
Yeah.
You're now responsible. Like you said, I think that's such a good way of putting it. The texture of their childhood is
it feels so loaded, doesn't it? And also because it's so precious. You know, childhood is so precious. And it's so kind of fleeting as well.
Yeah.
And realising, you know, I've got to, like, make the memories for them. The thing is, I think we put so much pressure on ourselves as well. I mean, of course we do. We know mothers, we all put loads and loads of pressure on ourselves.
But do you feel, and this is classic Carrie Ad Cod psychology, but like, because you had this lovely idyllic childhood and then that event happened, do you feel this pressure to try and make that idyllicness?
Oh my God, I completely have been driven absolutely crazy by trying to chasing after that idyllicness and chasing
what
after
you
it
had,
and trying to. And for when I had my eldest two, I was living in Oxford and I was a single mother. I actually loved being a single mother. I had a really, really close relationship with the children. My work was going quite well. Pretty broke, but it was okay. I was making it work. And then when I had the third, Evangeline, I felt like an increasing sense, and then I had my fourth, Dash, little boy, of like, I've got to give the kids the same kind of childhood that I had, which was out in the countryside and them kind of, you know, an idyllic idea of them running around in a big garden and stuff like that. And I was living in a house in Oxford with the third and fourth that was, it was basically like living in a flat because the kitchen and sitting room were on the first floor and it didn't have a garden. So in order to go outside and do anything, you had to take everybody out all the time. And I felt like I was kind of shut into this house with these, with all my babies. And yeah, the you know, that sort of yearning for, the yearning and melancholy of motherhood, yeah. I'm totally fascinated by, and whether it is linked to grief in some way or another.
It's hard, isn't it, when you, like, obviously different situations, but we both had it cut off, very, it's gone.
Mm.
And I think I definitely have a pressure of, like, I'd like it to be as nice as possible for as long as possible.
Mm.
Because I don't know if you have this, I have such, like, death anxiety. I have such worry about, but what if I go?
What something
what if,
happens?
Yeah, because you know it's like.
I think that, like, catastrophizing thing is, I feel like there's a timer on.
Yeah.
And I've got to grab hold of every single moment as fast as possible. And
I have that. And my fear is, I'll live to fucking 100 and I'll be like so annoyed because I'll be like, I did everything, guys, to make sure it was all done. And they're like, and now what, you're still here? And you're like, oh God, it's awkward. I sort of thought it would be a bit more dramatic and I'd be gone and okay. It's like awkward petering out.
But it's a strange feeling that, isn't
yeah.
it? That's that sense that it is a, you know, it's a very finite, there's a feeling that it's very, very yeah. finite. And I
think if you've had anything traumatic as well, like, I think everybody's aware of it, but I feel like that thought is just very loud in my head.
Yeah.
Of like, I'm aware something bad could happen.
Yeah.
And so it's quite hard. I find it very hard to turn that down.
It's really, really hard to turn yeah. it down if it's really imprinted itself on you.
Oh,
and my
yeah.
Pete, my husband, says to me, look, because I'm always, it's been very strange, and you'll probably find this as well with your daughter, that when your child gets to the same age that you were when, for me, it was when the accident
imagine,
happened.
Yeah. So when, as soon as you said that about Jimmy being your age, I was like, oh God, that.
I know.
Because you're looking, and even though he's a boy, you're still looking at that little version of yourself. And,
totally,
yeah.
totally. And it was, it was actually, I mean, it's possible. And that's when I had my third and fourth baby, when Jimmy was coming up to that age. And
yeah.
it's possible, I think that I was, because I feel a bit calmer right now, as maybe because Lester, my youngest one, he's going to be 2 this summer. So it does, I don't feel as kind of crazed as that last, you know, that first year of babyhood,
yeah.
and Lester the fifth, he actually had really bad reflux, so he did cry a lot, and that was quite exhausting. But Jimmy, who's now 17, like his mid-teenage life, I was really in quite a state of anxiety that something horrendous was about to happen, which is like the accident happening
yeah.
again. And my husband kept saying to me, like, it's not, you know, it's not the same thing. It's not
but
all about
so
to end.
It's so easy to say. Mm. My therapist says it every week. I'm just like, I know, because I always say to, but I have this evidence of my life
yeah.
that it was fine and it got snatched.
Mm.
And she was like, yes, but look at all these other things. I'm like, I don't see those other things.
Mm.
I just, it's so imprinted as a 15-year-old girl, everything's fine, everything's not fine. And that, like you said, that line, that moment, that
yeah.
profound moment. And it's really hard to let that go and not stress about it.
Really weird, the feeling, because all of that is true. Something, you know, the same thing is not going to happen again.
Yeah,
I was 16 when it happens, but Jimmy is now 17. He's past the age that I was.
I'd feel good about that. He got it. He got through.
But something bad is going to happen at some
yeah,
point as well.
Yeah.
That's inevitable.
Yeah.
That's what we were talking about a few moments ago. You know,
it
is part of being human.
Yeah.
And sometimes I look at my children and I think, oh my God, you know, what things are you going to have to face?
Yeah.
But also, I mean, that in itself is really interesting as well, because I was, when I did my book last year, I did an event with Deka Aitkenhead, actually, who is a brilliant writer, brilliant journalist, and she wrote her really incredible memoir, All at Sea, about the death of her husband.
I know, I've got that book, and I was like, I haven't read it yet. Yes, yeah, yeah.
And she was saying that, you know, in life you feel, and I definitely feel this, I feel drawn to people who have had trauma and who've had the, you know, faced the big, massive, great big challenges. And those people feel interesting and they feel compelling and they feel sympathetic and empathetic and the people that you want to talk to. But then obviously with your own children, you don't want to like wish.
Yeah, yeah.
You want them to have interesting
yeah,
lives.
Yeah, but you don't want them to go through what you went through.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, it's very true, because again, it's like how you spin things, isn't it? Like I define myself by my dad dying then.
Mm.
Like it totally makes me who I am and it's affected a lot of things. But the fear that she'll go through that
yeah.
is like, it's my worst fear. Like
yeah.
it just makes me feel sick. But yet, yeah, that is interesting.
But I almost felt like I was so worried about it with Jimmy getting up to that age that I almost felt like I'm going to end up doing something awful in order to make it happen again.
No, I know, because you do worry about yourself, don't you? I know exactly what you think. Oh, God, what am I going to do? Like, because it is, I mean, I'm not even at that where, you know, the bit you're at. I can't imagine when I see her at 15, I'm going to find that very hard. But then also my automatic thought is, if she gets to 15, if I get to see that, like, my brain just loves to fucking catastrophize.
The fear of it all.
Oh, the fear. So, you have your 5 children and your mum's still in the care home. What happened, like, how did she die then? What eventually happened?
So she actually died when I was pregnant with my fourth. So my youngest, Lester, didn't actually meet her. But she was in care homes. There was about 2 or 3 that she was in until 2013. And it was very strange because she had very, very profound brain damage and she had a lot of medical issues around that. She developed eczema all over her body, which was really painful. And then she was doubly incontinent and those two things would react with each other and she would get infections and stuff like that. And she had to have all her teeth taken out because she'd like refused to brush her teeth or have her teeth brushed. So she was getting ulcers and she had epilepsy. She was dealing with a lot of like physical pain as well as possibly, and we won't know what it is, but possibly really extreme torment, you know, or moments of understanding about something that had happened before. But she was in this state and she was alive and she was actually, you know, I'm quite a kind of physically strong person. I'm very much very, very like her actually in physically, her hands and stuff. And she wasn't a tiny, frail little thing. She was kind of, and also her mother died in her 90s. Her aunt died in her like 102 or something. Yeah. So we thought she might live for a long, long time. In fact, I thought my entire adult, I might be an old woman by the time mum actually even died. And I did, you know, I can say now, I did want her to die as well. Like, it was a real sense that she was in love.
I don't blame you for that. That's an unbelievable amount of stuff to deal with, to see your mum in that pain.
Yeah, the suffering that she went through and actually that my entire family went through because we were all... Going to see her was always really, really, really sad. Mm. It was never a nice... You know, it was never enjoyable, and I'd sit with her and try and like I'd talk to her, and it's very weird as well talking to someone who can't talk back, and you just have this like monologue
that
goes on
for
2 years, and I'd go in with one husband and 2 children, and then come back, have no husband, have another child, another husband. So all these massive things were happening in my life outside, and she was just in this home. But then she developed kidney failure, basically. Oh, wow. And her GP rang me up and said, she's probably not going to make it through, like, the next 3 weeks. And then, but then she did, and then she was kind of okay. And then your brain is a kind of, like, snooker balls of confusion because you've been told she's going to die, and you brace yourself for grief, and then she doesn't die. But then, I had wanted her to die, and then she doesn't die. So then you're sort of slightly thinking, how long is this going to go on for, you know? And I've kind of been at her bedside for the last 20 years.
Yeah.
Am I going to, you know, this thing of being on high alert all the time is really, really difficult to live with. But she actually did they said she'd, you know, she might not make it through a month, and she died about 9 months later. And she died, it was very strange, it was actually quite a shock when it happened. Like, she deteriorated really, really rapidly right at the end. And so she went from being sitting in her chair and she would drink a cup of tea or whatever to, like, she just suddenly looked like someone in the last sort of week, really. It became clear that she was going to die. She suddenly looked like a very, very old, frail lady. And I was with her in the moments when she died, actually. And it was at dawn, and it's pretty incredible, appalling, interesting, kind of strange, terrifying moment of it all end, you know, it all being over. Her
that
life
must have been
over.
So you've been sat there for 22 years waiting, really bracing, and then you're there and it happens,
and then it happens, and I was with my sister Nell that afternoon, and we'd all, my brothers and sister, we'd all been together, and then at the end of the day it was just me and Nell, and we were like packing up her bedroom from the nursing home, which just felt so unbelievably sad. And Nell said, I feel like a very long film has just finished because you've just been watching this kind of life forever. And I felt like, I actually felt like, you know that scene in, you know Gladiator?
Yes.
You know Russell Crowe in Gladiator? You know, by the end of the film, he's like stumbling around.
He's all so exhausted.
He's done everything. And his body is all like ripped and you know, he's got cuts and bleeding and he's got like a sword and a shield maybe. I felt like Russell Crowe, like stumbling off a battlefield.
Well, yeah, I'm not surprised. Like,
and I really, really, I wrote this memoir a couple of years ago about this whole journey. And when I was writing it, I got to the end of the book and then I realised I was writing this epilogue, which was about the fact that I had been living with what I thought was grief, which I had been living with grief because there'd been this profound sense of loss.
It's definitely a grief, of course.
But what I'd really been living with was trauma, and trauma and grief are really different things. And trauma is kind of my experience of trauma, and obviously we all have different experiences, but my experience of trauma is it's something lively and almost kinetic and energetic. And throughout after Mum's accident, I went off around the world and did some fairly crazy things living with... I sort of horse related. So I went to live in Ireland and lived with New Age travellers and was living in a horse drawn wagon for 2 years and buying and selling horses. And then straight after university, I went off to America and I lived in Texas and I was working on a ranch and riding in rodeos and stuff and riding quite dangerous horses.
So, yeah.
Later on, I was in Russia with this horseman for quite a long time, who I'd met. He was in England performing. And then I went over to the Caucasus Mountains, which is quite a dangerous place to go to. It's like beside Chechnya. Mm. The point of this is that when I was writing the epilogue, I realised that people used to say to me, oh, God, all those things that you went and did were so self-destructive and it must have been because of your mum. And why did you go and get on the most dangerous sort of horses possible? And I wrote something in the epilogue about the fact that I felt like going off on these kind of wild adventures with quite wild men was quite good fun, I have to say as well. I mean, that was the point of it. It was good fun. But also it felt like my way of surviving, and it felt like I was in battle I was on this sort of battlefield with trauma, and I wasn't going to let the trauma get the better of me and basically sort of destroy me. And the way of going out into the dangerous places was a way of sort of facing it all the time. And that was really, really, writing that was really useful.
But that's so fascinating. I think that's so, and also I mean, as ever, cause psychology, it's never as simple as like, oh, you went to look for a dangerous horse. It's like, I think that's so because I guess your mum's illness as well and her trauma is just very, like you said, it's just happening.
Mm.
So I can totally see that urge to go, well, I'm going to go and do something. Because I can't do anything.
Yeah.
So I am going to get that horse and battle it and win. Because this is something that's tangible.
And it's also like the opposite, because she was, you know, in a nursing home, which is, you know, fairly claustrophobic. Yeah. The fact that I could go out into these wild places was my kind of way. And also because something deeply traumatic had happened to me when I was 16, I do think that was a kind of desire for, I mean, I call it strong motion, to feel things really, in a really, really intense way. It was almost into my DNA. It was almost into my sort of experience of being an adult, I suppose.
I was saying this on another podcast, like, I just do intense.
Yeah.
Like, I can't really do light. No. And I was at a party on Saturday. Within 2 minutes, I was talking to someone about, you know, like the mortality, what it means, why we're here. At this full-on cool party, everyone having a nice time, everyone drunk. And I was like,
totally the same.
I just can't. And I fought that my whole life of like, there's something wrong with me. And now I'm just like, I had this very intense experience.
Yeah.
And I guess the only thing I can like relate it to is like, you know, like I had friends when I was a teenager and like their first boyfriend was wild. And then after that, they just couldn't go normal.
Yeah.
They were like, every boyfriend would have to be wild.
Yeah.
And I feel the same thing. Like when your first like taste of trauma is very intense and painful, it's like you go, whoa, I need to keep doing it to keep understanding it because I'm still making sense of it.
But I like hearing that, what you say about that, you know, straight away you go into, because actually I found that, I don't know if you ever, like when with your daughter being a baby, of done any baby groups or anything, but when I have tried to do baby groups, I just found myself asking the most basically inappropriate questions. You know, I'll be sitting in a ring, supposedly singing Wind the Bobbin Up or something, and suddenly I'm asking someone, like, what's their experience of death or domestic violence or, you know, and I just, it doesn't sit very well in a baby group type of context.
I found baby groups very difficult, very difficult. And then sometimes you would find another intense mum, and then you'd both be like, yeah, like depression, and also this, and my boobs were doing it. Like, I just feel like I just want to be like, let's get it out of straight away.
Yeah, I can't. Definitely.
I'm happy for Wind the Bobbin Up a couple of verses, but then I want. And again, who's to say? Maybe you'd have been like that anyway.
Yeah,
if your mum, happened to your mum. But life turns up certain parts of you, doesn't it?
Yeah,
I think it definitely turned up my need to connect and communicate and be intense with people very quickly.
Yeah,
because I still have that, like, there isn't time. Yeah, I feel there isn't time to muck around
for anything other than that.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. Like, if you're going to
just cut to the chase.
Yeah,
basically.
I don't mind this one, but I can't do bullshit. Mm. I find that really hard of like, oh, we're all just joking. I'm like, no, let's just talk about the fact we're all going to die and let's get that done because we might all die and then we won't have had that conversation. Yeah. It's so intense.
Haven't you found, though, that having kids has intensified that as well?
Yeah. I think doing a podcast, again, that...
yeah.
Again, it's the things people say to you, like, I chose to do that. I chose to start this podcast talking about death as I was, you know, I was pregnant. And then I've continued to do it as I've hit the 20th anniversary of my dad's death. Mm. And, you know, lots of people have said, is this a good thing? And you're like, good isn't the right word.
Yeah,
like,
I just, it's the only thing.
It's the only thing. Yeah. I just need to.
Yeah, definitely.
Yes, it'd probably be more, like, I don't know, safer not to do those things, but that's not...
But you need to kind of...
Yeah, you want to keep investigating. So you were there when she died.
And I was pregnant with Dash. I was pregnant with my fourth when she died, actually.
How pregnant were you?
I was... he was born in April. I was about 5 months pregnant.
Oh.
Yeah, I was about five months pregnant.
Enough for the hormones to really...
Yeah, definitely. Although, actually, then when it was then the grieving, you know, that first few weeks of intense grief, I was actually really quite relieved that I couldn't drink at that point. Because I really fucking well wanted to drink. And I'm sure it would have made the pain so much worse, definitely. And being able to go through the grieving process with complete kind of clarity, I suppose. And also, you know, when you're pregnant, you do have that kind of... I quite enjoy that middle bit of pregnancy when you're sort of not too massive,
it's nicer than the beginning.
You feel quite energetic and quite powerful in a way.
And you had Dash.
Yeah.
And did you say you did have postnatal depression?
I had postnatal depression with Evangeline, who's older than Dash, and then I had it again with Dash as well.
But then I was thinking, I'm not surprised. Like, your mum had just
died. My mum had just died,
That must be so connected.
And also something really, really amazing happened to me when I was giving birth to Dash. So all the other kids had met mum, you know, before she died. But with Dash, and then Leslie, who comes after him, but with Dash... I was giving birth and I was in that part of labour where you just think you're having really big contractions and you just think, I can't do this. I just want to escape. I'm just going to leave. You know, I'm just going to leave the room. I just can't fucking well do this.
So I'm scared. Stay in there. They'll stay in there. It's fine.
And I was in this incredible... I gave birth in the hospital in Oxford and there's a really wonderful maternity unit at the top of the hospital. And I had this incredibly strong sense, not in a, like, woo-woo way, not in a sort of, a feeling of her, but I had a really, really strong feeling that my mum was suddenly in the room.
Aww.
And that she was saying, come towards me. Come towards me, come over. Because I personally believe that when we're in labour, we go to that point which is like touching, you know, I'm not, this is not an original idea. Lots of other people have written and thought about this. And Tolstoy wrote about it, I know, in Anna Karenina, I think. But that you touch the kind of brink between life and death.
Definitely.
You know, you are not of this world. You're not just in a room. You're
in
a
most insane
different
experience.
Place.
However it happens to you, it is the most insane thing, yeah.
And I felt like up until that point, my body was resisting, going, I can't do this. I'm wanting to run away from the pain. And she said, come over, and she sort of beckoned me forwards. And at that point, I moved into the... Actually, I find it quite heartbreaking to talk about. I moved towards her into the other place where she was, because she was dead at this point. And at that point, the labour became easier. Then I, well, it didn't become easier, but then I sort of started like pushing the baby out, and then it was Dash. And I do genuinely feel that I saw her and that she was like helping me through that moment.
That's amazing.
And that I was on, you know, she was in the place that you are when you're dead, and I was in the place that you are when you're still alive. But then we sort of met in the middle because I was in childbirth. And when Dash was born, he was actually quite ill when he was born. I had a bit of a difficult time for the first, because he's a really funny, great, big, huge, blonde, big, fat boy now. But he was a tiny, tiny baby, and he wouldn't eat very much. And so I had to go, and when he was 2 weeks old, I had to go into hospital with him, and they said he might be really ill. It was quite difficult and traumatic, and I think that maybe that kind of precipitated, you know, some kind of postnatal depression. And I also, we were talking earlier about, you asked me whether, you know, whether I felt like I was always having to kind of go after, you know, trying to create the memories. Definitely after Dash was born, I felt like this overwhelmingly powerful sense of that responsibility we were talking about, and I've got to like, and I've got to kind of give them the same childhood. And at that point, we moved out of Oxford and we moved into the countryside, which is not like a massively big deal, but at the time, it felt like quite a big deal moving my almost teenage son out into the countryside. And my husband is not at all, you know, he'd like lived in cities all his life, so that all felt quite a big upheaval. And I had the feeling again of depression, of being separated from the rest of the world, in a sort of state of grief with the baby. It's so strange, isn't it?
I really feel for people who have to go through it and in the middle of having a baby, because I even though it brought up a lot of stuff for me having a baby, and I definitely have, you know, the grief comes back in because of the whole childbirth thing. I have had a couple of friends who either got pregnant very quickly after losing a parent, or it happened while they're pregnant. And I really think it, because it's such a massive crucible
of emotions to be holding, isn't it?
And to lose your mum after such a long time as well, of like waiting. Did you feel like your grief had been on pause and then you were just able to do it finally?
Yeah, I definitely felt like I thought that I had been grieving, but actually I realised when she died, this feeling of something, the kind of, because when, until you've actually experienced grief, you don't know what the physicality of it. I found absolutely extraordinary, like walking down the street and feeling like, you know, when you see footage of somebody who's on the moon or something like that, and you can hear that breathe, you know, with when you can hear somebody breathing, and like that, and I felt like I was walking, I felt like the pavement was completely uneven and my feet couldn't stand on the ground properly. Yeah, and I felt, even though I had children and a husband, I felt like very, very incredibly lonely and alone as well, and I felt a strong desire to be with my sisters, my siblings,
that family,
basically.
Needing to be with people who suddenly put you back in that family position. Definitely
that felt really, really, really strong. But the kind of and I wrote a piece for the Telegraph about, because I became really fascinated by the grieving process and whether kind of different nationalities and different eras and different religions did it better than us.
I thought the constant search for, is there a good way of doing this?
A good way of doing it. I was really interested by the way the Victorians did it, of completely, you know, the ritual of grief and the pageant of grief and like dressing their houses with black curtains and all black clothes and mourning lockets, and they would have to wear like black underwear it was a long time. But then it was actually thought of as a kind of patriarchal form of oppression of women, because a woman would have to grieve more kind of publicly and more in a higher way for her husband than she would for her child.
Oh, wow.
So one of the things that the suffragettes did was to like move away from that grieving process.
Oh,
that
wow.
was quite, that was something that felt
but
important.
But it's so interesting, because I think, as with all things, every time something, like, they're right. I'm with the suffragettes. I'm not anti them. I think they were good. They're right to move away from that grieving process. But whenever something's moved or changed, obviously there's consequences. And we talk about this a lot of, like, I think the public display is a shame that we don't have that, especially in kind of, like, I'm talking from a very Western, secular, you know, I'm trying to make sure I cover heteronormative, like the idea of not being able to wear a black armband or wear black, and then people don't know why you can't walk down a pavement.
Yeah.
I think it's a shame that we've lost that sense.
No, definitely.
But obviously, Victorians went too far, as they did with a lot of things.
Yeah.
See the empire. Like, it's a shame that those rituals came from a good place, but then obviously they get twisted into other things.
Yeah, but it also makes you really realise in the way that we live now, we have very few rituals and conventions.
If you're not religious,
and
actually, yeah.
No, and I have to say, after Mum died, I absolutely crave... I mean, I was brought up in the Church of England, but not massively religious, but I did really, really crave the solemnity of... Yeah. Going in, you know, I went to mass and I wanted to like really, I couldn't stand being out in the normal world and like people just, you know, that Auden poem about stop the clocks is just so brilliant because you do think, how the fuck is the world just going on? How come everyone, and the weird thing was actually Mandela died when at this in the same week or 2 weeks as well. So the whole world was actually mourning at the same time. It was quite an amazing, amazing sense that there was this like massive sense of grief. And obviously it was for Mum. You know? That's what it felt like to me.
Well, I had a weird thing that the year before my dad, so like maybe like 4 months before, Princess Diana died.
Oh, really?
And everyone had been going on about mourning, you know, and it was still kind of going on when he died. And I remember that feeling of like, I liked it. I was like, good, this feels right. We should all be feeling a bit sad about everything.
Yeah.
Like, because there's nothing worse than walking down the road and seeing people laughing and being like, how are you laughing?
No, I know.
How are you walking and eating and laughing?
Yeah.
When I can't do any of those things.
But like, do you think there should be... You can't really say there should be. How would we be doing it? How could we sort of help people better?
I just sort of wish. I think the baby on board badge is an incredible invention, right? Mm. You know, what they did before that, I don't know. But the fact that now we have a society where if I'm 6 weeks pregnant and throwing up every day, I have this badge. You know, if you're not listening, this is what you wear on the tube. And then people go, oh, that woman needs a seat.
Yeah.
Like, and I feel like some kind of symbol, like just grieving.
Yeah.
You know, hashtag new to the dead club. And then just have somebody be like, oh, please go in front of me. Mm. Oh, excuse me, madam, you dropped your hat. Like, I don't know. I want the 40s. I think I want the 40s. But just like, I feel
you
like...
You put a cloak over this puddle for you.
Just like that care. I mean... I suppose it's a cliche as ever. People say, you know, don't judge people. Everybody's fighting their own hidden battles.
Yeah.
And I think because I am very aware of grief and I'm in the grief club,
yeah.
I feel like if I knew or if I could see just that look you could give someone of like, hey, you know, like, I know how you feel or, I've been through it. I just think badges are a good idea, guys. Yes. It seems like the simplest, easiest way to do it. But my mum always says that, you know, she wore the black armband when her grandparents died and they had to wear it to school.
Mm.
And she was like, people were just a bit careful with you.
Yeah.
Or would say, oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we've lost in the ritual is that sense of it being acknowledged. And I think, you know, we live in a very anonymous way.
Mm.
Like, you can... tell, you can lie, you can make your Instagram life look amazing and you can hide, and so I think it's hard for people to acknowledge sometimes what's happening to you because they just don't know.
No, and also we sort of like, you know, if you're in love, you're, it's a kind of, you know, like we celebrate the lovers with Valentine's Day and love songs and hearts and roses.
Mourner's Day?
But we don't, but, you know.
That's
but,
a good idea,
but
Clover.
The bereaved are sort of like taken off, you know, they're in a private space. Don't disturb them.
And
you
I think, yeah, I think that's
happened
it.
To them.
People who aren't in the club feel like, oh, I better leave them alone.
Mm.
And so you feel more lonely.
Mm.
And that's what I'm constantly talking about. It's like, no, bash on their door.
Yeah.
Those people who are like, oh, I'm fine, leave me alone. That's they need the door hand down. They need you to turn up with food, uninvited, and just be in your house.
To be there. No, and also to go on, not just, you know, because I think that we also assume there's like, you know, people, so if somebody dies and it's about 2 weeks when there's a funeral and then after that, it's kind of back to work, back to normal.
Yeah.
Might feel a bit sad, but like normal life resumes. And the feeling of the disbelief and the anger and the
shock,
the kind of unreality of it, goes on for such a long time. And trying to shuffle people through it as quickly as possible, I think, isn't kind of the right way to be doing things.
And again, this is where it comes back to childbirth. You have a kid, people give you, you know, 2 weeks or 6 months of like, oh, yeah, and then they're like, okay, now shuffle through, please start behaving normally.
Yeah.
And you're sort of, I felt very like, oh, I can't behave normally. I don't understand what's being asked of me because everything's changed.
Yeah.
And it reminded me so much of being 15 and going, I can't be at school like a normal teenager because everything's changed. Why is everyone expecting me to act the same?
How long do you feel since your daughter's been born? Like, how long do you feel that feeling of things being different and odd? And how long did that go on for you?
I think, again, similar to grief, I think the first 12 months, I would say, are the worst.
Yeah.
And there's a phrase I've used a lot, which is you have to go through every season, they say, with grief.
Mm.
So you have to have each season without that person. Mm. And somewhere in your brain, you're like, they didn't see winter, they didn't see flowers, you know. And I feel like that with, you see the baby, you know, my baby was born in winter and it was cold. And then I saw her grow as the flowers came out and then she was in her little dresses. And then we hit winter again. And I was like, wow, we did it.
Mm.
Like, we got through that year.
Yeah.
And I had everyone's different, but I had a huge thing about 12 months. And I think grief doesn't go away after 12 months. Being a mum doesn't get magically brilliant at 12 months, but just I think something in human beings needs each season and needs a year.
Yeah.
And I think that I always
the
say
cycle,
to people,
and get around to the winter again, when you've gone through the four cycles, it's like, oh, here we are again, and I've kind of survived it and got
and
through
they're not,
it.
And they're not here. And I guess for you, like, I haven't visited her for a year. That's what that's definitely my life.
Mm.
It feels like that's how long it takes for your brain. You know, they say, like, it takes 2 weeks for, like, nicotine to get out of your system. I feel like it takes 12 months for your body, for your brain to literally accept someone's dead.
Yeah.
Because I think, and even then, I think after 12 months, it was like, okay, he's dead.
Mm.
Now I've got to deal with it. Like, now how do I feel about it? Because I think for 12 months, I was just like, what?
Yeah, you're kind of reeling really still.
But then it must
you?
Be so different because you, like you said, you were grieving, sort of grieving for such a long time. I think that's really interesting what you said about trauma and grief. Because I think I do speak to a lot of people who say, my parent is sick, or, you know, they have Alzheimer's or dementia. I feel like I always think it's such a different thing.
It's really
it's
different.
It's such a different thing once someone is really gone.
No, because I had it for such a long time, I did. And Mum was in nursing homes with people, you know, elderly people who had dementia or Alzheimer's. And that, at the longest, I think I'm right in saying something like Alzheimer's, you know, may last for like 12 years.
Mm.
So we all had like a long time to kind of examine what was going on, I suppose. Although I think it took about a decade, honestly, for us to accept. I mean, I know that, speaking for myself, that she wasn't going to get better. Because for the first few years, what had happened was so awful. We were all sort of saying, when she gets better, you know, it wasn't as though... So she lived at home for 2 years and then she was in rehabilitation centre and then she went into nursing home. We didn't then think, okay, this mum, you know, this is it. We still thought she's going to get better and keep on going and visiting her and taking things and she's going to get better, she's going to get better. And I think that we were telling ourselves that in order to be able to survive this, like, profound, profound sense of loss, but also the horror... Because if you'd said, like, Mum's going to be... She's going to be in this state, actually.
Mm.
And you know, if she'd died, it would have been appalling, but it would have been more straightforward because there would have been, you know, the funeral, there would have been all the kind of things to organise, then there would have been a more... As you say, like a year, you know, it would have been fine after a year. Of course it wouldn't have been fine after a year. But because she was just in this, it was as though someone like just pressed pause on everything.
Do you feel angry? Do you feel angry that your life kind of got paused?
Did that. I feel really, really, I don't think I feel angry. I feel upset still for her that she's missed out on so much.
Yeah.
I feel... really, really upset for my children.
Yeah.
Like, I really find that really upsetting that they missed out on a grandmother, you know, her as a grandmother. And I do have a feeling of sometimes, like, intense, really, really green-eyed jealousy towards people
we
who
talk
have
about
a mother.
That a lot.
And that's...
Oh, my God, we talk about it so much. People, especially, I think, once you have kids, the grandparent thing.
Yeah.
If I see people with like the two, I mean, people I say, find
oh,
granddads
my mum's being
difficult.
Really
like,
annoying. People say yeah, my mum's being so annoying at the moment. I just think, oh God, just try and, you know, enjoy their presence in some way. Or
I find it very hard when people complain, and like in a rational way, because of course people are annoying. Like, and I would moan about my mum, you know, because my dad isn't here, and I would happily, but oh, she did this, blah blah blah. Blah. But we talk about that a lot. I find it very hard if people are, oh, the bloody grandparents around. I'm like, grandparents?
No, I know.
Like, you're so lucky.
Yeah.
And I, but then, you know, it's, you can't make people, you can't shove their face in the shit and be like, look what it could be like. But it is, I think that's a new pain.
Yeah.
A new pain that you grieve for them and your relationship. And then when you have kids, it's like, oh, hi, new pet. I didn't know I'd have to grieve for them as a grandparent.
Yeah, exactly.
I just grieve for them as my parent. Yeah. Yeah, it's really tough.
Yeah.
Especially like you said, she was obviously great with kids and your brain goes, oh, they would have been this.
She would have been a brilliant, brilliant grandmother.
It's so hard,
definitely.
Isn't it? I kind of, the only way I spin it, I don't know what you do, but he would, I mean, he was a difficult dad, but he would have been a great grandpa. He would have been. And the only way I spin it is like, some people don't have that. Some people have lame grandparents.
No, totally.
And I think, well, at least I know he would have been a good.
No,
you know?
I mean, I feel like, oh, I had an amazing mother for 16 years. I mean, and what an amazing blessing and gift that is. I had an amazing mother, and I can hopefully give the kids stuff, you know, which is absolutely passed on from her.
Yeah.
And I mean, I wish it was her doing it.
Yeah.
I wish it was her. But I do, I feel like I'm really, 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 really lucky to have had her as a mom, and that's what you kind of try and hold on to through the, because the feeling of it coming back and of missing. I was with my son actually in a restaurant. In fact, it was the day of the, I took him to his parents' evening. We went to the classroom where I was, where when I heard that she'd had the accident. And then later on, I took him out. We went to this Thai restaurant and had supper. I saw somebody walking past the restaurant who just vaguely looked like her.
Yeah.
And you still get that feeling of like, oh my God, like being
so
sort of
much,
hit by a sense of loss or shock almost. Like a kind of, you know, it's like being pinched or something isn't it? It's quite a physical feeling still of longing.
I guess one of the things, the obsession we're talking about as well, is like, it's just very hard to explain. And I don't know if you have this. I still feel like I haven't nailed it.
Yeah.
I still feel like I try and I say all these jokey things and I still think, no, it's not quite, like, I know that what you're talking about, that feeling when you see someone. It's such a strange sensation. The fact that 20 years on, I still get like, you know, oh, that guy looks like my dad.
Yeah.
And I'm remembering a man 20 years ago. Like, he wouldn't have looked like that.
How old was he when he died?
He was 44.
So he was really, really
Yeah, he was
really young.
And it's funny, you talk about ages, like my brother's not there yet, but I feel like I'm very aware of like, oh, we're coming up to that. We're coming up to my brother being that age, which is, it's just the way that human beings place significance on things, which I'm sure you can be like, it doesn't matter. But of course it does. It fucking does. You know, you can analyse it way all you like. But yeah, he was 44, which is, at the time, I thought was the very old.
You
know, people kept saying he was young. And I remember thinking, I don't know if you had this with your mum, but thinking, she was quite old.
She was quite old. Yeah. Mum was in her early 50s.
Oh, God.
And I remember thinking, I was the last of the five children.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
She, as I will be to my youngest. In fact, Jimmy was saying, God, I feel so sorry for Lester. You're just going to seem like you're going to be such an old mum at the school gates. Because obviously when he was little, I was like in my mid-20s. So I probably did seem relatively young. But I remember thinking mum was quite old, but she was 52, 51.
God.
You know, she wasn't old at all, really, when she had the accident.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, exactly. That's the problem, is you see everything as a teenager slightly. So I remember that people being very upset, and I remember thinking, well, he was old, you know, like, guys. He was an old man in a way. And now I hit near it.
Yeah.
I think, fuck. Yeah. Like, if one of my friends, happened to my friends, I'd be so shocked. And be so. And I now understand that adult shock and the adult horror, the way they looked at me as a teenager.
Yeah.
And I think that's the other thing, as you get older, if you get the privilege of getting older, you do start to understand people's reactions to you. Like, oh yeah, that's why they were so upset for me. But at the time I was like, you don't get it, you don't understand.
And
oh yeah, they did understand how sad that was. So what anniversary? So it was 2013 that she died. So I'm not every time on the show. What anniversary have you are you coming up to?
5 years.
5 years.
5 years of her death.
Yeah, of her death.
Yeah.
But it must, the anniversaries must feel strange for you because...
Yeah, I mean, I actually find the anniversary of her accident is more
Yeah,
loaded.
I was
going to
say, that must be more...
That's in November.
Yeah.
And that feels more like... I mean, that's just always been such a massive date in my life.
But that's,
and it also happens in November when the world is, like, getting dark and it's wintry. And so, and also after the accident, I just remember driving, or we would, because we lived about an hour from where she was in hospital, and she was in hospital for like 4 months, 5 months to start with. So we were driving to hospital every day. So it was that thing of always driving through the night to go and, or the darkness it felt like to go and see her on really cold days in when she was in intensive care in Bristol. And that kind of period of time, you know, that time of the year always like, it just reminds you of it. And it's like, it's a kind of atavistic sort of physicality that you can't, you know, you can't escape from it. It's just kind of there inside you,
I'm not,
the feeling.
I'm not surprised at that anniversary because that is when you lost her, really, isn't it? That was like...
Yeah, definitely. I mean, weirdly, she actually died in December as well.
Oh,
so it's just all at the same time.
All together. The whole time of year.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, it's really hard. Mm. And how are you feeling about the, like, the 5 years? Do you feel... Do you feel your grief has changed in those 5 years, or are you still processing the beginning bit?
Well, I think that there's... I mean, it changes. It really changes. And, I mean, something really, really awful happened. I didn't actually mean to talk about this particularly, but at the end of last year, her sister, who was incredible, very, very energetic, vital, brilliant woman, and only 70, was killed in an accident.
Oh.
And it was very, has been, and that was very, very recent, but it's been very strange. Mum and my aunt Teza, like both, Mum wasn't killed in the accident, but it's like them both having these lives cut short. Because my aunt, although she was 70, she, you know, she should have had another 2 decades easily.
Yeah.
And so I think that, and she was the second, there was a person that I've strong, like felt strong grief, Mum and her for. And so I think that has changed my experience of grief because it's become, I now see it as something more, I mean, grief is layered and anyway, you know, we know about the different stages of grief and how they can swap around and the kind of, but when you lose somebody, when some, you know, when it happens again, I suppose, is...
I think that's quite common as well. Like you're sort of like, when you, what do I, what happened to me? Like your first death after is like, you're like, I got this. And then you're like, oh shit.
Yeah.
Like I remember when my husband's dad got cancer and died and I found it so difficult. Like it was just like flashbacks and it was just the same kind of nurses and the same medication being taught. And suddenly I was like almost panic attacking, just like, oh, I'm back. And I was, I didn't, you know, because you've sort of got your head around one. I do think it's,
I also feel this real incredibly strong sense of like, you know, for her children and her husband, my aunts, I feel... Well, when you see somebody else that you really love, you know, is going through it as well, is the kind of feeling of, what is it? I actually feel angry for them that they're having to go through it as well. And the feeling of intense sympathy and empathy, I suppose.
And you've obviously written about it as well. Did you find that helpful?
I found it really, really, really helpful. I found it, it was really, I mean, I'd done journalism for about 15 years, but, and then after Mum died, I knew that I wanted to write about her, and I knew also that I had all these quite, you know, sort of interesting stories about travelling and adventuring and going and bravery and what bravery is and what survival is. And then I got the idea for how I would structure, that after she died, I sort of felt like, okay, now I'm going to structure the her life and the sort of story as a narrative, because it was like when she was alive I did bits of journalism where I wrote about her, but I couldn't write about her life because I didn't know what was, you know, it was this unending sense.
Yeah,
of
like you said, it was still going.
And it was just like it was this sounds like totally contradictory, but like a living sense of loss because it was just it was there all the time. It was when she was alive, like you were left with this sort of strong, strong feeling of the loss just being around all the time. And then after she died, I thought I kind of know how her story ends now, so I can write about her and write about it. And yeah, it was useful, but I don't think the feeling of loss. People have said, oh, has it been cathartic? And catharsis suggests that you want to sort of get rid of these feelings and become somebody, you know, afterwards there'd be some sort of rebirth from getting rid of. But the trauma and the loss and the sadness are all totally, totally part of who I am. And they're totally like part of the way that I communicate and part of the way that I live. And I think I actually live in a very... I've someone who's really gone after life, and my book is very much about like it's about living and loving and enjoying stuff, and it's very confessional, and it's about sort of the excitement of being alive as much as the acute pain of being alive as well, and the acute pain of loving because you're gonna lose somebody as well.
I think you can't be someone that lives life to the full without knowing what you're. In a way, not running from, but in a way, what the other is round the corner.
Yeah.
And that's why you're having a great time right now.
Yeah.
These things are intrinsically linked.
Yeah, definitely.
And so the book is available now.
Now, yeah.
In paperback.
It's in paperback at the moment.
Which is great because no one likes a hardback.
I know.
They're big and they're heavy.
Yeah.
But they have to come out first. And what's it called?
It's called The Wild Other.
The Wild Other. Mm. Amazing. Well, Clover, thank you.
Thank you
so much.
So great talking to you. I've really, really... really enjoyed it, found it really interesting. It's been brilliant.
I can't wait to read about the hot Russian man in the Caucasus. It's in the book, right?
It is in the book, and cowboys, and sex, and drugs, and adventures, and grief. Yeah,
that is so up my listener's alley. It's perfect. Clover Stroud, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
You can buy Clover's book, The Wild Other, and it's out now in paperback. It's an incredible story, as you've just heard, and absolutely beautifully written. You can also follow her on Twitter and Instagram at Clover Stroud and see herself and her wonderful 5 children in action. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast or email us thegriefcast@gmail.com. Please do also rate, review and subscribe if you have enjoyed the show. It really is so appreciated. Music was provided by The Glue Ensemble and the show was edited by Kate Holland with thanks to Whistledown Studios. And remember, you are not alone.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.